which spun the tortuous speculations on the chances of death and the fortunes of the succession. His thoughts hurried him. There were his three sons, three straight-backed youths full of promise and virtue. Where did they disappear on these bad days? Waiting, no doubt, each watching the other and all watching him. He stirred uneasily. And now Brodrig craved audience. The low-born, faithful Brodrig. Faithful because he was hated with a unanimous and cordial hatred that was the only point of agreement between the dozen cliques that divided his court. Brodrig, the faithful favorite, who had to be faithful, since unless he owned the fastest speed ship in the galaxy and took to it the day of the Emperor's death, it would be the radiation chamber the day after. Cleon II touched the smooth knob on the arm of his great divan, and the huge door at the end of the room dissolved to transparency. Brodrig advanced along the crimson carpet and knelt to kiss the Emperor's limp hand. "Your health, sire," asked the Privy Secretary in a low tone of becoming anxiety. "I live," snapped the Emperor with exasperation. "If you can call it life, where every scoundrel who can read a book of medicine uses me as a blank and receptive field for his feeble experiments. If there is a conceivable remedy, chemical, physical, or nuclear, which has not yet been tried, why then some learned babbler from the far corners of the realm will arrive tomorrow to try it. And still another newly discovered book, or forgery, more the like, will be used as authority." "By my father's memory," he rumbled savagely, "it seems there is not a biped extant who can study a disease before his eyes with those same eyes. There is not one who can count a pulse beat without a book of the ancients before him. I'm sick, and they call it unknown. The fools! If in the course of millennia human bodies learn new methods of falling askew, it remains uncovered by the studies of the ancients and incurable forevermore. The ancients should be alive now, or I then." The Emperor ran down to a low-breathed curse while Brodrig waited dutifully. Cleon II said peevishly, "How many are waiting outside?" He jerked his head in the direction of the door. Brodrig said patiently, "The great hall holds the usual number." "Well, let them wait. State matters occupy me. Have the captain of the guard announce it. Or wait, forget the state matters. Just have it announced. I hold no audience. And let the captain of the guard look doleful. The jackals among them may betray themselves." The Emperor sneered nastily. "There is a rumor, sire," said Brodrig smoothly, "that it is your heart that troubles you." The Emperor's smile was little removed from the previous sneer. "It will hurt others more than myself if any act prematurely on that rumor. But what is it you want? Let's have this over." Brodrig rose from his kneeling posture at a gesture of permission and said, "It concerns General Bel Rioz, the military governor of Suenna." "Rioz?" Cleon II frowned heavily. "I don't place him. Wait, is he the one who sent that quixotic message some months back?" "Yes, I remember. He panted for permission to enter a career of conquest for the glory of the Empire and Emperor." "Exactly, sire." The Emperor laughed shortly. "Did you think I had such generals left me, Brodrig? He seems to be a curious atavism. What was the answer? I believe you took care of it." "I did, sire. He was instructed to forward additional information and to take no steps involving naval action without further orders from the Imperium." "Hm. safe enough. Who is this Rios? Was he ever at court? Broderick nodded, and his mouth twisted ever so little. He began his career as a cadet in the Guards 10 years back. He had part in that affair off the Lemuel Cluster. The Lemuel Cluster? You know, my memory isn't quite... Was that the time a young soldier saved 2 of the ships of the line from a head-on collision by... something or other? He waved a hand impatiently. I don't remember the details. It was something heroic. Rios was that soldier. He received a promotion for it, Broderick said dryly, and an appointment to field duty as captain of a ship. And now military governor of a border system and still young. Capable man, Broderick. Unsafe, sire. He lives in the past. He is a dreamer of ancient times, or rather, of the myths of what ancient times used to be. Such men are harmless in themselves, but their queer lack of realism makes them fools for others. He added, his men, I understand, are completely under his control. He is one of your popular generals. Is he? The Emperor mused. Well, come, Broderick, I would not wish to be served entirely by incompetence. They certainly set no enviable standard for faithfulness themselves. An incompetent traitor is no danger. It is rather the capable men who must be watched. You among them, Broderick? Cleon II laughed and then grimaced with pain. Well, then you may forget the lecture for the while. What new development is there in the matter of this young conqueror? I hope you haven't come merely to reminisce. Another message, sire, has been received from General Rios. Oh, and to what effect? He has spied out the land of these barbarians and advocates an expedition in force. His arguments are long and fairly tedious. It is not worth annoying your Imperial Majesty with it at present, during your indisposition, particularly since it will be discussed at length during the session of the Council of Lords. He glanced sidewise at the Emperor. Cleon II frowned. The Lords? Is it a question for them, Broderick? It will mean further demands for a broader interpretation of the Charter. It always comes to that. It can't be avoided, sire. It might have been better if your august father could have beaten down the last rebellion without granting the Charter. But since it is here, we must endure it for the while. You're right, I suppose. Then the Lords, it must be. But why all this solemnity, man? It is, after all, a minor point. Success on a remote border with limited troops is scarcely a state affair. Broderick smiled narrowly. He said coolly, it is an affair of a romantic idiot. But even a romantic idiot can be a deadly weapon when an unromantic rebel uses him as a tool. Sire, the man was popular here and is popular there. He is young. If he annexes a vagrant barbarian planet or two, he will become a conqueror. Now a young conqueror who has proven his ability to rouse the enthusiasm of pilots, miners, tradesmen, and such like rabble is dangerous at any time. Even if he lacked the desire to do to you as your august father did to the usurper, Ricker, then one of our loyal lords of the domain may decide to use him as his weapon. Cleon II moved an arm hastily and stiffened with pain. Slowly he relaxed, but his smile was weak and his voice a whisper. You are a valuable subject, Broderick. You always suspect far more than is necessary, and I have but to take half your suggested precautions to be utterly safe. We'll put it up to the Lords. We shall see what they say and take our measure accordingly. The young man, I suppose, has made no hostile moves yet?
He reports none, but already he asks for reinforcements.
Reinforcements? The Emperor's eyes narrowed with wonder. What force has he? 10 ships of the line, sire, with a full complement of auxiliary vessels. 2 of the ships are equipped with motors salvaged from the old Grand Fleet, and 1 has a battery of power artillery from the same source. The other ships are new ones of the last 50 years, but are serviceable nevertheless. 10 ships would seem adequate for any reasonable undertaking. Why, with less than 10 ships, my father won his first victories against the usurper. Who are these barbarians he's fighting? The Privy Secretary raised a pair of supercilious eyebrows. He refers to them as the Foundation.
The Foundation?
What is it? There is no record of it, sire. I have searched the archives carefully. The area of the galaxy indicated falls within the ancient province of Anacreon, which 2 centuries since gave itself up to brigandage, barbarism, and anarchy. There is no planet known as Foundation in the province, however. There was a vague reference to a group of scientists sent to that province just before its separation from our protection. They were to prepare an encyclopedia. He smiled thinly. I believe they called it the Encyclopedia Foundation.
Well, the Emperor considered it somberly. That seems a tenuous connection to advance.
I'm not advancing it, sire. No word was ever received from that expedition after the growth of anarchy in that region. If their descendants still live and retain their name, then they have reverted to barbarism, most certainly.
And so he wants reinforcements.
The Emperor bent a fierce glance at his secretary. This is most peculiar. To propose to fight savages with 10 ships and to ask for more before a blow is struck. And yet, I begin to remember this Rios. He was a handsome boy of loyal family. Broderick, there are complications in this that I don't penetrate. There may be more importance in it than would seem. His fingers played idly with the gleaming sheet that covered his stiffened legs. He said, I need a man out there. One with eyes, brains, and loyalty. Broderick? The secretary bent a submissive head.
And the ships, sire?
Not yet. The Emperor moaned softly as he shifted his position in gentle stages. He pointed a feeble finger. Not till we know more. Convene the Council of Lords for this day week. It will be a good opportunity for the new appropriation as well.
I'll put that through, or lives will end.
He leaned his aching head into the soothing tingle of the force field pillow. Go now, Broderick, and send in the doctor. He's the worst bumbler of the lot.
Chapter 5. The War Begins. From the radiating point of Suenna, the forces of the Empire reached out cautiously into the black unknown of the periphery. Giant ships passed the vast distances that separated the vagrant stars at the galaxy's rim and felt their way around the outermost edge of Foundation influence. Worlds isolated in their new barbarism of 2 centuries felt the sensation once again of Imperial overlords upon their soil.
Allegiance was sworn in the face of the massive artillery covering capital cities. Garrisons were left. Garrisons of men in imperial uniform with the spaceship and sun insignia upon their shoulders. The old men took notice and remembered once again the forgotten tales of their grandfathers' fathers, of the times when the universe was big and rich and peaceful, and that same spaceship and sun ruled all. Then the great ships passed on to weave their line of forward bases further around the foundation. And as each world was knotted into its proper place in the fabric, the report went back to Belrioz at the general headquarters he had established on the rocky barrenness of a wandering, sunless planet. Now Rioz relaxed and smiled grimly at Duke Umbar.
"Well, what do you think, Patrician?"
"I?
Of what value are my thoughts? I am not a military man."
He took in with one wearily distasteful glance the crowded disorder of the rock-bound room which had been carved out of the wall of a cavern of artificial air, light, and heat, which marked the single bubble of life in the vastness of a bleak world.
"For the help I could give you," he muttered, "or would want to give you, you might return me to Siwenna."
"Not yet. Not yet." The general turned his chair to the corner which held the huge, brilliantly transparent sphere that mapped the old imperial prefect of Anacreon and its neighboring sectors. "Later, when this is over, you will go back to your books and to more. I'll see to it that the estates of your family are restored to you and to your children for the rest of time."
"Thank you," said Barr, with faint irony. "But I lack your faith in the happy outcome of all this."
Rioz laughed harshly. "Don't start your prophetic croakings again. This map speaks louder than all your woeful theories."
He caressed its curved, invisible outline gently.
"Can you read a map in radial projection?"
"You can. Well, here, see for yourself.
The stars in gold represent the imperial territories. The red stars are those in subjection to the Foundation, and the pink are those which are probably within the economic sphere of influence."
"Now watch."
Rioz's hand covered a rounded knob, and slowly an area of hard white pinpoints changed into a deepening blue. Like an inverted cup, they folded about the red and the pink.
"Those blue stars have been taken over by my forces," said Rioz with quiet satisfaction.
"And they still advance.
No opposition has appeared anywhere. The barbarians are quiet.
And particularly no opposition has come from Foundation forces.
They sleep peacefully and well."
"You spread your force thinly, don't you?" asked Barr.
"As a matter of fact," said Rioz, "despite appearances, I don't. The key points which I garrison and fortify are relatively few, but they are carefully chosen. The result is that the force expended is small, but the strategic result great. There are many advantages, more than would ever appear to anyone who hasn't made a careful study of spatial tactics. But it is apparent to anyone, for instance, that I can base an attack from any point in an enclosing sphere, and that when I am finished it will be impossible for the Foundation to attack at flank or rear.
I shall have no flank or rear with respect to them. This strategy of the previous enclosure has been tried before, notably in the campaigns of Loras VI some 2,000 years ago, but always imperfectly. Always with the knowledge and attempted interference of the enemy. This is different."
"The ideal textbook case." Barr's voice was languid and indifferent.
Rioz was impatient. "You still think my forces will fail?"
"They must."
"You understand that there is no case in military history where an enclosure has been completed that the attacking forces have not eventually won, except where an outside navy exists in sufficient force to break the enclosure.
If you say so.
And you still adhere to your faith.
Yes.
Rios shrugged.
Then do so.
Barr allowed the angry silence to continue for a moment, then asked quietly, "Have you received an answer from the Emperor?"
Rios removed a cigarette from a wall container behind his head, placed a filter tip between his lips, and puffed it aflame carefully. He said, "You mean my request for reinforcements?"
"It came, but that's all. Just the answer."
"No ships?"
"None. I half expected that. Frankly, Patricia and I should never have allowed myself to be stampeded by your theories into requesting them in the first place. It puts me in a false light."
"Does it?"
"Definitely. Ships are at a premium. The civil wars of the last 2 centuries have smashed up more than half of the Grand Fleet, and what's left is in pretty shaky condition. You know, it isn't as if the ships we build these days are worth anything. I don't think there's a man in the galaxy today who can build a first-rate hypernuclear motor."
"I knew that," said the Sewenian.
His eyes were thoughtful and introspective.
"I didn't know that you knew it."
"So his Imperial Majesty can spare no ships. Psychohistory could have predicted that. In fact, it probably did. I should say that Harry Seldon's dead hand wins the opening round."
Rios answered sharply, "I have enough ships as it is. Your Seldon wins nothing. Should the situation turn more serious, then more ships will be available. As yet, the Emperor does not know all the story."
"Indeed.
What haven't you told him?"
"Obviously, your theories."
Rios looked sardonic.
"The story is, with all respect to you, inherently improbable. If developments warrant, if events supply me with proof, then, but only then, would I make out the case of mortal danger."
"And in addition," Rios drove on casually, "the story, unbolstered by fact, has a flavor of lèse-majesté that could scarcely be pleasant to his Imperial Majesty."
The old patrician smiled. "You mean that telling him his august throne is in danger of subversion by a parcel of ragged barbarians from the ends of the universe is not a warning to be believed or appreciated? Then you expect nothing from him. Unless you count a special envoy as something."
"And why a special envoy?"
"It's an old custom. A direct representative of the crown is present on every military campaign which is under government auspices."
"Really? Why?"
"It's a method of preserving the symbol of personal imperial leadership in all campaigns. It's gained a secondary function of ensuring the fidelity of generals. It doesn't always succeed in that respect."
"You'll find that inconvenient, General."
"Extraneous authority, I mean." "I don't doubt that," Rios reddened faintly, "but it can't be helped."
The receiver at the General's hand glowed warmly, and with an unobtrusive jar, the cylindered communication popped into its slot.
Rios unrolled it.
"Good. This is it."
Duke Ambar raised a mildly questioning eyebrow. Rios said, "You know, we've captured one of these traitor people.
Alive. And with his ship intact."
"I've heard talk of it."
"Well, they've just brought him in, and we'll have him here in a minute. You keep your seat, Patrician. I want you here when I'm questioning him. It's why I asked you here today in the first place. You may understand him where I might miss important points."
The door signal sounded, and a touch of the General's toe swung the door wide. The man who stood on the threshold was tall and bearded, wore a short coat of a soft, leathery plastic with an attached hood shoved back on his neck. His hands were free, and if he noticed the men about him were armed, he did not trouble to indicate it. He stepped in casually and looked about with calculating eyes. He favored the general with a rudimentary wave of the hand and a half nod. "Your name?" demanded Rios, crisply.
"Lathan Devers."
The trader hooked his thumbs into his wide and gaudy belt.
"Are you the boss here?"
"You are a trader of the Foundation."
"That's right. Listen, if you're the boss, you'd better tell your hired men here to lay off my cargo."
The general raised his head and regarded the prisoner coldly. "Answer questions. Do not volunteer orders."
"All right. I'm agreeable. But one of your boys blasted a 2-foot hole in his chest already by sticking his fingers where he wasn't supposed to."
Rios shifted his gaze to the lieutenant in charge.
"Is this man telling the truth?"
"Your report, Vrank, had it that no lives were lost."
"None were, sir," the lieutenant spoke stiffly, apprehensively. "At the time, there was later some disposition to search the ship, there having arisen a rumor that a woman was aboard. Instead, sir, many instruments of unknown nature were located, instruments which the prisoner claims to be his stock in trade. One of them flashed on handling, and the soldier holding it died."
The general turned back to the trader. "Does your ship carry nuclear explosives?"
"Galaxy, no. What for? That fool grabbed a nuclear puncher, wrong end forward, and set at maximum dispersion. You're not supposed to do that.
Might as well put a newt gun at your head. I'd have stopped him if 5 men weren't sitting on my chest." Rios gestured at the waiting guard. "You go. The captured ship is to be sealed against all intrusion. Sit down, Devers."
The trader did so in the spot indicated and withstood stolidly the hard scrutiny of the Imperial general and the curious glance of the Suenian patrician. Rios said, "You're a sensible man, Devers."
"Thank you."
"Are you impressed by my face, or do you want something?"
"Tell you what, though. I'm a good businessman."
"It's about the same thing. You surrendered your ship when you might have decided to waste our ammunition and have yourself blown to electron dust. It could result in good treatment for you if you continue that sort of outlook on life."
"Good treatment is what I mostly crave, boss."
"Good. And cooperation is what I mostly crave."
Rios smiled and said in a low aside to Duke Umbar, "I hope the word crave means what I think it does. Did you ever hear such a barbarous jargon?"
Devers said blandly, "Right, I check you. But what kind of cooperation are you talking about, boss? To tell you straight, I don't know where I stand."
He looked about him.
"Where's this place, for instance, and what's the idea?"
"Ah, I've neglected the other half of the introductions. I apologize."
Rios was in good humor.
"That gentleman is Duke Umbar, Patrician of the Empire. I am Bel Rios, Peer of the Empire, and General of the 3rd Class in the Armed Forces of His Imperial Majesty."
The traitor's jaw slackened.
"Then, the Empire? I mean, the old empire they taught us about at school?"
"Huh. Funny. I always had the sort of notion that it didn't exist anymore."
"Look about you. It does," said Rios grimly.
"Might have known it, though," and Lathan Devers pointed his beard at the ceiling. "That was a mightily polished-looking set of craft that took my tub. No kingdom of the periphery could have turned them out."
His brow furrowed.
"So what's the game, boss? Or do I call you general?"
"The game is war."
"Empire versus Foundation, that it?"
Right.
Why?
I think you know why.
The trader stared sharply and shook his head. Rios let the other deliberate, then said softly, I'm sure you know why.
Lathan Devers muttered, warm here, and stood up to remove his hooded jacket. Then he sat down again and stretched his legs out before him.
You know, he said comfortably, I figure you're thinking I ought to jump up with a whoop and lay about me. I can catch you before you could move if I choose my time, and this old fellow who sits there and doesn't say anything couldn't do much to stop me.
But you won't, said Rios confidently.
I won't, agreed Devers amiably. First off, killing you wouldn't stop the war, I suppose.
There are more generals where you came from.
Very accurately calculated.
Besides which, I'd probably be slammed down about 2 seconds after I got you and killed fast. Or maybe slow, depending. But I'd be killed, and I never like to count on that when I'm making plans. It doesn't pay off.
I said you were a sensible man.
But there's one thing I would like, boss. I'd like you to tell me what you mean when you say, I know why you're jumping us. I don't. And guessing games bother me no end.
Yes. Ever hear of Harry Seldon?
No. I said I don't like guessing games.
Rios flicked a side glance at Dukem Barr, who smiled with a narrow gentleness and resumed his inwardly dreaming expression. Rios said with a grimace, Don't you play games, Devers. There is a tradition, or a fable, or sober history, I don't care what, upon your foundation, that eventually you will found the Second Empire. I know quite a detailed version of Harry Seldon's psycho-historical claptrap and your eventual plans of aggression against the Empire.
That's so.
Devers nodded thoughtfully.
And who told you all that?
Does that matter? Said Rios with dangerous smoothness. You're here to question nothing. I want what you know about the Seldon fable.
But if it's a fable, don't play with words, Devers.
I'm not. In fact, I'll give it to you straight. You know all I know about it. It's silly stuff, half-baked. Every world has its yarns. You can't keep it away from them. Yes, I've heard that sort of talk. Seldon, Second Empire, and so on. They put kids to sleep at night with the stuff. The young squirts curl up in the spare rooms with their pocket projectors and suck up Seldon thrillers. But it's strictly non-adult. Non-intelligent adult, anyway. The trader shook his head. The Imperial General's eyes were dark.
Is that really so? You waste your lives, man. I've been on the planet Terminus. I know your foundation. I've looked it in the face.
And you ask me? Me, when I haven't kept foot on it for 2 months at a piece in 10 years? You are wasting your time. But go ahead with your war if it's fables you're after.
And Barr spoke for the first time, mildly. You are so confident, then, that the Foundation will win.
The traitor turned. He flushed faintly, and an old scar on one temple showed whitely.
The silent partner. How'd you squeeze that out of what I said, Doc?
Rios nodded very slightly at Barr, and the Suenian continued in a low voice,
Because the notion would bother you if you thought your world might lose this war and suffer the bitter reapings of defeat, I know. My world once did, and still does.
Lathan Devers fumbled his beard, looked from one of his opponents to the other, then laughed shortly.
Does he always talk like that, boss?
Listen, he grew serious. What's defeat? I've seen wars, and I've seen defeats. What if the winner does take over? Who's bothered? Me? Guys like me?
He shook his head in derision. Get this, the trader spoke forcefully and earnestly. There are 5 or 6 fat slobs who usually run an average planet. They get the rabbit punch, but I'm not losing peace of mind over them. See? The people? The ordinary run of guys? Sure. Some get killed, and the rest pay extra taxes for a while, but it settles itself out. It runs itself down. And then it's the old situation again with a different 5 or 6.
Dukumbar's nostrils flared and the tendons of his old right hand jerked, but he said nothing.
Lathan Devers' eyes were on him. They missed nothing. He said, look, I spend my life in space for my 5 and dime gadgets and my beer and pretzel kickback from the combines. There's fat fellows back there, his thumb jerked over his shoulder and back, that sit home and collect my year's income every minute out of skimmings from me and more like me. Suppose you run the Foundation. You'll still need us. You'll need us more than ever the Combines do, because you'd not know your way around, and we could bring in the hard cash. We'd make a better deal with the Empire. Yes, we would, and I'm a man of business. If it adds up to a plus mark, I'm for it. And he stared at the two with sardonic belligerence. The silence remained unbroken for minutes, and then a cylinder rattled into its slot. The general flipped it open, glanced at the neat printing, and encircuited the visuals with a sweep. Prepare plan indicating position of each ship in action. Await orders on full armed defensive. He reached for his cape. As he fastened it about his shoulders, he whispered in a stiff-lipped monotone to Barr, I'm leaving this man to you. I'll expect results. This is war, and I can be cruel to failures. Remember. He left with a salute to both. Lathan Devers looked after him. Well, something's hit him where it hurts. What goes on? A battle, obviously, said Barr gruffly. The forces of the Foundation are coming out for their first battle. You'd better come along. There were armed soldiers in the room. Their bearing was respectful and their faces were hard. Devers followed the proud old Suenian patriarch out of the room. The room to which they were led was smaller, barer. It contained 2 beds, a visi-screen, and shower and sanitary facilities. The soldiers marched out, and the thick door boomed hollowly shut. Hmm. Devers stared disapprovingly about. This looks permanent. It is, said Barr shortly. The old Suenian turned his back. The trader said irritably, What's your game, Doc? I have no game. You're in my charge, that's all. The trader rose and advanced. His bulk towered over the unmoving patrician. Yes, but you're in this cell with me, and when you were marched here, the guns were pointed just as hard at you as at me. Listen, you were all boiled up about my notions on the subject of war and peace. He waited fruitlessly. All right, let me ask you something. You said your country was licked once. By whom? Comet people from the outer nebulae? Barr looked up. By the Empire. That's so. Then what are you doing here? Barr maintained an eloquent silence. The traitor thrust out a lower lip and nodded his head slowly. He slipped off the flat-linked bracelet that hugged his right wrist and held it out. What do you think of that? He wore the mate to it on his left. The Suenian took the ornament. He responded slowly to the trader's gesture and put it on. The odd tingling at the wrist passed away quickly. Devers' voice changed at once. Right, Doc, you got the action now. Just speak casually. If this room is wired, they won't get a thing. That's a field distorter you've got there. Genuine Mallow Design. Sells for 25 credits on any world from here to the Outer Rim. You get it free. Hold your lips still when you talk and take it easy. You've got to get the trick of it. Duke Umbar was suddenly weary. The trader's boring eyes were luminous and urging. He felt unequal to their demands. Barr said, "What do you want?" The words slurred from between unmoving lips. "I've told you. You make mouth noises like what we call a patriot, yet your own world has been mashed up by the Empire, and here you are, playing ball with the Empire's fair-haired general. Doesn't make sense, does it?" Barr said, "I have done my part. A conquering imperial viceroy is dead because of me."
"That's so.
Recently?" 40 years ago. 40 years ago. The words seemed to have meaning to the traitor. He frowned. "That's a long time to live on memories. Does that young squirt in the general's uniform know about it?" Barr nodded. Devers' eyes were dark with thought. "You want the Empire to win?" And the old Sewenian patrician broke out in sudden, deep anger. "May the Empire and all its works perish in universal catastrophe. All Sewenna prays that daily. I had brothers once, a sister, a father. But I have children now. Grandchildren. The general knows where to find them." Devers waited. Barr continued in a whisper, "But that would not stop me if the results in view warranted the risk. They would know how to die." The traitor said gently, "You killed a viceroy once, huh? You know, I recognize a few things. We once had a mayor. Hober Mallow, his name was. He visited Sewenna. That's your world, isn't it? He met a man named Barr." Duke Umbar stared hard, suspiciously. "What do you know of this?" "What every trader on the Foundation knows. You might be a smart old fellow put in here to get on my right side. Sure, they'd point guns at you and you'd hate the Empire and be all out for its smashing. Then I'd fall all over you and pour out my heart to you, and wouldn't the general be pleased? There's not much chance of that, Doc. But just the same, I'd like to have you prove that you're the son of Onam Barr of Sewenna, the sixth and youngest who escaped the massacre." Duke Umbar's hand shook as he opened the flat metal box in a wall recess. The metal object he withdrew clanked softly as he thrust it into the traitor's hands. "Look at that," he said. Devers stared. He held the swollen central link of the chain close to his eyes and swore softly. "That's Mallow's monogram, or I'm a space-struck rookie, and the design is 50 years old if it's a day." He looked up and smiled. "Shake, Doc. A man-sized nuclear shield is all the proof I need." And he held out his large hand. Chapter 6. The Favorite. The tiny ships had appeared out of the vacant depths and darted into the midst of the armada. Without a shot or a burst of energy, they weaved through the ship-swollen area, then blasted on out, while the Imperial wagons turned after them like lumbering beasts. There were two noiseless flares that pinpointed space as two of the tiny gnats shriveled in atomic disintegration, and the rest were gone. The great ships searched, then returned to their original task, and world by world, the great web of the enclosure continued. Broderick's uniform was stately, carefully tailored and as carefully worn. His walk through the gardens of the obscure planet Wanda, now temporary Imperial headquarters, was leisurely. His expression was somber. Belrios walked with him, his field uniform open at the collar and doleful in its monotonous gray-black. Rios indicated the smooth black bench under the fragrant tree fern whose large spatulate leaves lifted flatly against the white sun.
"See that, sir? It is a relic of the Imperium. The ornamented benches built for lovers linger on, fresh and useful, while the factories and the palaces collapse into unremembered ruin."
He seated himself while Cleon II's privy secretary stood erect before him and clipped the leaves above neatly with precise swings of his ivory staff. Rios crossed his legs and offered a cigarette to the other. He fingered one himself as he spoke. "It is what one would expect from the enlightened wisdom of His Imperial Majesty to send so competent an observer as yourself. It relieves any anxiety I might have felt that the press of more important and more immediate business might perhaps force into the shadows a small campaign on the periphery."
"The eyes of the Emperor are everywhere," said Broderick mechanically.
"We do not underestimate the importance of the campaign. Yet still it would seem that too great an emphasis is being placed upon its difficulty. Surely their little ships are no such barrier that we must move through the intricate preliminary maneuver of an enclosure." Rios flushed, but he maintained his equilibrium. "I cannot risk the lives of my men, who are few enough, or the destruction of my ships, which are irreplaceable, by a too rash attack. The establishment of an enclosure will quarter my casualties in the ultimate attack, howsoever difficult it be. The military reasons for that I took the liberty to explain yesterday."
"Well, well, I am not a military man. In this case, you assure me that what seems patently and obviously right is, in reality, wrong.
We will allow that. Yet your caution shoots far beyond that. In your second communication, you requested reinforcements, and these against an enemy poor, small, and barbarous, with whom you have had not one skirmish at the time. To desire more forces under the circumstances would savor almost of incapacity, or worse, had not your earlier career given sufficient proof of your boldness and imagination."
"I thank you," said the general, coldly, "but I would remind you that there is a difference between boldness and blindness. There is a place for a decisive gamble when you know your enemy and can calculate the risks at least roughly, but to move at all against an unknown enemy is boldness in itself. You might as well ask why the same man sprints safely across an obstacle course in the day and falls over the furniture in his room at night."
Broderick swept away the other's words with a neat flirt of the fingers.
"Dramatic, but not satisfactory. You have been to this barbarian world yourself. You have, in addition, this enemy prisoner. You coddle this traitor. Between yourself and the prisoner, you are not in a night fog."
"No. I pray you to remember that a world which has developed in isolation for 2 centuries cannot be interpreted to the point of intelligent attack by a month's visit. I am a soldier, not a cleft-chinned, barrel-chested hero of a sub-etheric tri-dimensional thriller. Nor can a single prisoner and one who is an obscure member of an economic group which has no close connection with the enemy world introduce me to all the inner secrets of enemy strategy."
"You have questioned him?"
"I have."
"Well?"
"It has been useful, but not vitally so. His ship is tiny, of no account. He sells little toys, which are amusing, if nothing else. I have a few of the cleverest, which I intend sending to the Emperor as curiosities. Naturally, there is a good deal about the ship and its workings, which I do not understand, but then I am not a tech man.
But you have among you those who are, pointed out Broderick.
I, too, am aware of that, replied the general in faintly caustic tones. But the fools have far to go before they could meet my needs. I have already sent for clever men who can understand the workings of the odd nuclear field circuits the ship contains. I have received no answer.
Men of that type cannot be spared, General.
Surely there must be one man of your vast province who understands nucleics.
Were there such a one, I would have him heal the limping, invalid motors that power two of my small fleet of ships. Two ships of my meager 10 that cannot fight a major battle for lack of sufficient power supply. 1/5 of my force condemned to the carrion activity of consolidating positions behind the lines.
The secretary's fingers fluttered impatiently. Your position is not unique in that respect, General. The Emperor has similar troubles.
The General threw away his shredded, never-lit cigarette, lit another, and shrugged.
Well, it is beside the immediate point, this lack of first-class tech men. Except that I might have made more progress with my prisoner were my psychic probe in proper order.
The secretary's eyebrows lifted.
You have a probe.
An old one. A superannuated one which fails me the one time I needed it. I set it up during the prisoner's sleep and received nothing.
So much for the probe.
I have tried it on my own men, and the reaction is quite proper, but again there is not one among my staff of tech men who can tell me why it fails upon the prisoner.
Duke Umbar, who is a theoretician of sorts, though no mechanic, says the psychic structure of the prisoner may be unaffected by the probe, since from childhood he has been subjected to alien environments and neural stimuli.
I don't know. But he may yet be useful. I save him in that hope.
Broderick leaned on his staff.
I shall see if a specialist is available in the capital. In the meanwhile, what of this other man you just mentioned, this Suenian? You keep too many enemies in your good graces.
He knows the enemy. He, too, I keep for future reference and the help he may afford me.
But he is a Suenian and the son of a proscribed rebel.
He is old and powerless, and his family acts as hostage.
I see. Yet I think that I should speak to this traitor myself.
Certainly.
Alone, the secretary added coldly, making his point.
Certainly, repeated Rios blandly. As a loyal subject of the Emperor, I accept his personal representative as my superior. However, since the traitor is at the permanent base, you will have to leave the front areas at an interesting moment.
Yes. Interesting in what way?
Interesting in that the enclosure is complete today. Interesting in that within the week the 20th Fleet of the Border advances inward toward the core of resistance.
Rios smiled and turned away.
In a vague way, Broderick felt punctured.
Chapter 7. Bribery.
Sergeant Maury Luke made an ideal soldier of the ranks. He came from the huge agricultural planets of the Pleiades, where only army life could break the bond to the soil and the unavailing life of drudgery. And he was typical of that background. Unimaginative enough to face danger without fear, he was strong and agile enough to face it successfully. He accepted orders instantly, drove the men under him unbendingly, and adored his general unswervingly. And yet, with that, he was of a sunny nature. If he killed a man in the line of duty without a scrap of hesitation, it was also without a scrap of animosity. That sergeant look would signal at the door before entering was further a sign of tact, for he would have been perfectly within his rights to enter without signaling. The two within looked up from their evening meal, and one reached out with his foot to cut off the cracked voice which rattled out of the battered pocket transmitter with bright liveliness. "More books?" asked Lathan Devers. The sergeant held out the tightly wound cylinder of film and scratched his neck.
"It belongs to Engineer Orr, but he'll have to have it back. He's going to send it to his kids, you know, like what you might call a souvenir, you know."
Dukembar turned the cylinder in his hands with interest.
"And where did the engineer get it?
He hasn't a transmitter also, has he?"
The sergeant shook his head emphatically. He pointed to the knocked-about remnant at the foot of the bed.
"That's the only one in the place. This fellow Orr, now, he got that book from one of these pigpen worlds out here we captured. They had it in a big building by itself, and he had to kill a few of the natives that tried to stop him from taking it."
He looked at it appraisingly.
"It makes a good souvenir. For kids."
He paused, then said stealthily, "There's big news floating about, by the way.
It's only scuttlebutt, but even so, it's too good to keep. The general did it again."
And he nodded slowly, gravely.
"That's so," said Devers. "And what did he do?"
"Finish the enclosure, that's all."
The sergeant chuckled with a fatherly pride.
"Isn't he the corker, though? Didn't he work it fine? One of the fellows who's strong on fancy talk says it went as smooth and even as the music of the spheres. Whatever they are."
"The big offensive starts now?" asked Barr mildly.
"Hope so," was the boisterous response. "I want to get back on my ship now that my arm is in one piece again. I'm tired of sitting on my scupper out here."
"So am I," muttered Devers, suddenly and savagely. There was a bit of underlip caught in his teeth, and he worried it. The sergeant looked at him doubtfully and said, "I'd better go now. The captain's round is due, and I'd just as soon he didn't catch me in here." He paused at the door.
"By the way, sir," he said with sudden, awkward shyness to the trader, "I heard from my wife. She says that little freezer you gave me to send her works fine. It doesn't cost her anything, and she just about keeps a month's supply of food froze up complete. I appreciate it."
"It's all right. Forget it."
The great door moved noiselessly shut behind the grinning sergeant. Dukembar got out of his chair.
"Well, he gives us a fair return for the freezer. Let's take a look at this new book."
"Ah, the title is gone." He unrolled a yard or so of the film and looked through at the light. Then he murmured, "Well, skewer me through the scupper, as the sergeant says. This is the Garden of Summa, Devers."
"That's so," said the trader, without interest.
He shoved aside what was left of his dinner.
"Sit down, Barr.
Listening to this old-time literature isn't doing me any good. You heard what the sergeant said?"
"Yes, I did. What of it?"
"The offensive will start, and we sit here."
"Where do you want to sit?"
"You know what I mean.
There's no use just waiting." "Isn't there?"
Barr was carefully removing the old film from the transmitter and installing the new.
"You told me a good deal of Foundation history in the last month, and it seems that the great leaders of past crises did precious little more than sit and wait."
"Ah, Barr, but they knew where they were going."
"Did they?"
"I suppose they said they did when it was over. And for all I know, maybe they did.
But there's no proof that things would not have worked out as well or better if they had not known where they were going. The deeper economic and sociological forces aren't directed by individual men.
Devers sneered. No way of telling that things wouldn't have worked out worse, either. You're arguing tail end backwards.
His eyes were brooding.
You know, suppose I blasted him.
Whom?
Rios?
Yes.
Barr sighed. His age.